We're in Deuteronomy chapter 22. We're going to start in verse 28. This is a section of Moses' final address to the Israeli people that deals with how to distinguish between sexual interactions between men and women that are, some of them are unbetrothed, some of them are betrothed, some of it's in the country, some of it's in the city, and how the court needs to balance some of these things to understand what happened and how they should rule. As I mentioned toward the end of last session, this is long before forensic evidence became a commonplace procedure. These guys are having to deal with he said, she said, and just circumstantial evidence that might be available. Sometimes eyewitness testimony before or after the event. And so the rule of thumb seems to have been, because of the compact nature of cities, sexual relations must be consensual, unless, of course, there was some yelling going on. And then, of course, the people would run to wherever that yelling was going on to find out how the woman was being harmed. So if people are found engaged in sexual activity, then both are guilty of adultery, because in the circumstance that we are reading about, the woman was betrothed already. So she was most of the way to being married. And so it was an adulterous situation, and that's capital crime. The next example was if sexual activity was happening out in the country and the woman was betrothed, then it was assumed that it was consensual. That it was not consensual, that it was rape, because why would an engaged woman, a betrothed woman, agree to have sexual activity? She's already spoken for. She's already in a contract. So the man must have been a rapist, and so he is treated as such. So that was kind of what the court system had to use as their foundational assumptions. In the next example, we remove the idea of any type of betrothal. So both parties are single. They are not spoken for. They do not have any type of contractual obligations. They are not for the most part married. And so the wording, though, in our English Standard Version, and it's similar in other English versions, I think could be tweaked a little bit better to not give the impression that I've heard non-believers, Bible haters, try to portray this passage as. And that is forcing a woman to marry their rapist. And that is not what this passage is about. And so let's go ahead and read it. Verse 28 says, "If a man meets a virgin who is not betrothed," so the man is not engaged to anyone, the woman is not engaged to anyone, "and he seizes her." Now that, in our English Bible, that has a connotation of violence. The word in Hebrew and the word that is used in the Greek text does not have that natural connotation to it. It is the word for take hold of. And it could be just as easily understood of taking her into his arms. And we use that phrase in a very positive sense between a man and a woman. And so I think that when we have words that are neutral in a neutral context, we ought to use the neutral meaning. If a man meets a virgin who is not betrothed and takes hold of her and lies with her. Now, that's much more neutral. And I would suggest that what it's really talking about is a couple of unmarried people involved in a consensual relationship. And we know this happens all the time. And they end up being found. They are caught in the act, shall we say. Well, if they had either one of them been engaged, that would have been adultery, and they would have been executed. But this time, they're not engaged. But they are involved in sexual activity that they were not supposed to be involved in. So what happens? Then the man who lay with her shall give to the father of the young woman 50 shekels of silver, and she shall be his wife, because he has, the English Standard Version uses the word violated her. The literal meaning of the Hebrew and the Greek word means humbled. And I think in the context that is being presented here, we're talking about did not show the proper societal respect that was due for her as a virgin. He should have asked her to marry him and waited. That's effectively what should have happened. So what occurs is their action has basically resulted in them wanting to get married. That's what they seem to have indicated by being involved sexually. So the law told the man he had to give 100 days wages, a third of a year salary, to his now father-in-law as a dowry. That's a minimum. And has to marry the girl immediately. No betrothal period necessary now because they already jumped the gun, is the idea. And then we have this added thing. He may not divorce her all his days. He made his choice. She made her choice. They're now married till death do them part. That, I believe, is the proper understanding of this context. Now, in the other passage where this shows up, which is Exodus 22, 16 and 17, verse 17 of that context tells us something that Moses doesn't repeat here, and that is, if her father absolutely refuses to give her to him, he shall pay money equal to the dowry for virgins. So, dad and mom, in this circumstance, because the daughter's still at home, she's still considered to be under their authority. If mom and dad say, you are not marrying that boy, you are not marrying that man, then the dowry money still has to be paid, but the marriage is not going to go through. And this would happen in circumstances where mom and dad just feel like he's a bad choice, not someone that they would want being the dad to their grandkids. So that is the situation we find ourselves with Moses about here in the Deuteronomy passage. One more that has to do with marriage. This is Deuteronomy 22:30. A man shall not take his father's wife so that he does not uncover his father's nakedness. Now, folks, this is an automatic ooh in my mind. Ugh. Why in the world would you want to be involved with your stepmom? Now this is not his natural mom. This is another woman that dad has married at some other time after he'd been born. And we've seen a whole list of this sort of stuff back in Leviticus 18. It's just not appropriate. It's just not right. And so it should not be permitted. Chapter 23. Change of topic, which we know he's trying to cram in a whole bunch of stuff here. No man whose testicles are crushed or whose male organ is cut off shall enter the assembly of he who is. Now, the assembly of he who is seems to be a reference to those who can come into the courtyard for worship at the tabernacle. They can come into the front gate, into that worship area there by the altar. In the New Testament time period, it would have been the place beyond the barrier that is described as being around the court of women and the court of Israel and around the temple shrine area itself. Everything outside of that was the court of the Gentiles, the court of the nations. So there was this limitation that you had to be clean and whole in body in order to come across this boundary line into the worship area of the tabernacle or the temple. And so if you'd been castrated, whether accidentally or on purpose, if you had had some sort of serious surgery that took off your penis, you were not allowed to cross that line. Verse number 2. No one born of a forbidden union may enter the assembly of he who is, even to the 10th generation. None of his descendants may enter the assembly of he who is. The Israelis were supposed to be holy to he who is and worship him alone. Remember that Israel is the only theocracy ever put into place by God himself. And so every member of the Israeli nation was supposed to be monotheistic, devoted only to him. If you married outside that faith, that would be a forbidden union. And your kids would not be allowed to come into the worship assembly area, even as adults, even if they were very sincere believers. And that would go on until the 10th generation. And so the whole point was, don't let this stuff happen, because it has long-term serious ramifications. Verse number 3, same topic still. No Ammonite or Moabite may enter the assembly of he who is. So if you were from the line of Lot through his daughters, you know, which is what produced the Ammonites and the Moabites, then there was something not quite kosher, shall we say, about those genetic groups. And so they were not allowed to come into the worship area of the tabernacle, of the temple, even if they had converted, like, for example, Ruth. Ruth would not have been allowed to come into the worship area up close to the tabernacle. However, her children would have been able to, because of the fact that the genealogy followed the male line in Israel at this time. That was the tradition. Now, that's been flipped in modern times, I understand, where the Israeli government does not recognize you as Jewish unless you had a Jewish mom. And so we need to stay with the context of the time period that Moses was speaking into. So no Ammonite or Moabite may enter the assembly of he who is, even to the 10th generation, none of them may enter the assembly of he who is forever. So if it had been the female line that counted on this, then David would not have been far enough along to be allowed to come into close worship of God, into the worship area of the tabernacle. And he did, because his genetic identity came through his father, and the father before that, and the father before that. Now, the reason for this, verse 4, is because they did not meet you with bread and with water on the way when you came out of Egypt, and because they hired against you Balaam, the son of Beor from Pethor of Mesopotamia, to curse you. But he who is your God would not listen to Balaam. Instead, he who is your God turned the curse into a blessing for you, because he who is your God loved you. So the reminder is, these guys, the Ammonites and the Moabites, were not on your side in their history, as well as being a problem for the worship of the true God. And so you're not supposed to be making intimate relationships with these worshipers of other gods and goddesses. Verse 6, you shall not seek their peace or their prosperity all your days forever. You don't try to help them become part of your society, because their society is anathema to Israeli society, because the society core is, who does it worship? And the Moabites and the Ammonites did not worship the true and living God. Now, verse 7 is interesting. You shall not abhor an Edomite, for he is your brother. So the Edomites are descended from Esau, who was the twin brother of Jacob, who became Israel, and all Israelis come from Jacob or Israel. So the Edomites and the Israelis were considered brother nations. And so they could be assimilated into Israeli society quicker than the 10 generations. You shall not abhor an Egyptian, because you were a sojourner in his land. So there was an intimate connection there. It's possible that a lot of the Israelis had Egyptian blood in them. But verse number 8 says, children born to them in the third generation may enter the assembly of he who is. Any Edomite, any Egyptian that converted to the faith of Israel, it would take three generations of them before they could come into the assembly presence, based again on the genetic line of identity. The lady line does not count as much as the male line. All right, verse number 9, change of topic. When you're encamped against your enemies, you shall keep yourself from every evil thing. Now, this is talking apparently about military action, and that involves a military encampment program, a bivouacking. You don't take your city with you. Now, the Israelis, when they moved into the Promised Land, they all had cities, they all had houses. But if they went out to do war, then they lived in a tent city. And they needed to follow proper procedures when they did this. So verse number 10. If any man among you becomes unclean because of a nocturnal emission, so he has what is colloquially referred to as a wet dream, then he shall go outside the camp. He shall not come inside the camp, but when evening comes, he shall bathe himself in water, and as the sun sets, he may come inside the camp. So all of these camps had a defined border to it, And outside that border, there would have been the unclean camp, tents, the place where they would put the people that were sick or bleeding heavily, or in this case, they had a nocturnal emission. And so that's where everybody would go because they wanted their battle camp to be clean and holy. And so these parallel some of the things we know that happened for the Israeli encampment in the wilderness. Verse 12, you shall have a place outside the camp, and you shall go out to it, and you shall have a trowel with your tools, and when you sit down outside, you shall dig a hole with it and turn back and cover up your excrement. This is talking about a bathroom visit. You don't just go to the bathroom inside the camp. You go outside the clean boundary line. You dig yourself a hole, relieve yourself, cover your hole back up, and then come back into the encampment. Now, whether or not they practice something this in their wilderness encampment, I am not altogether certain. We know in our modern times that it is best to keep your toilet areas away from your fresh water sources and away from your cooking areas. And so it is possible, I think, that the Israelis did in fact have toilet arrangements outside the boundaries of each of their tribal encampments, that they told their people, that's where you go to relieve yourself. When I grew up, it was still quite common in southern Missouri to have outdoor toilets. We always put the outhouse far away from the wellhead and far away from the house. And you would traipse back and forth in order to do your business. Now, particularly in the winter months, but also anytime the weather was inclement, you would have what we referred to as the thunder pot inside the house that you could use to relieve yourself. And then when opportunity presented, you would take that out to the outhouse, to the toilet, and dump it down. And then you'd come back in with it after you've cleaned it. And so I think it's possible the Israelis in their wilderness encampment had something similar to that. But the goal would have been to keep the encampment clean. And hygiene would have been a really big bonus from taking that type of attitude. But in the context we're looking at here in Deuteronomy chapter 23, verse number 9 clearly indicates that we're talking about a battle encampment. And so it's not going to be so huge as to make it impracticable to have a toilet area outside of the living area. In fact, I'll use another example from my own life. I was in the Air Force. My reserve unit was activated during Desert Shield and Desert Storm. We were encamped at the end of one of the active tactical runways. We were a medical evac unit, so we needed to be at the apron at the end of the taxiway. And so that was where we had our tent city. And we had primitive toilet facilities, an outhouse. And it was outside of the area where we slept and where we ate and where we bathed and where we did our hospital duties. We had to walk a pretty good long way to get there. I think that's roughly the equivalent of what we're describing here, is keep that area away from where you spend most of your time. Verse number 14 gives a moral tie-in, an ethical tie-in, because he who is your God walks in the midst of your camp to deliver you and to give up your enemies before you. Therefore, your camp must be holy so that he may not see anything indecent among you and turn away from you. So basically, don't do your business out in front of God. Your king doesn't want to see that stuff, right? And if we were talking about a physical king, I can guarantee you, they don't want to see that stuff happening inside the camp. If my commanding officer had found out any of us were going just around the corner from the tent flap and doing our business in the middle of the night, he would have had a cow, and we would have ended up with an Article 15. Back to Deuteronomy 23, verse 15 now. Change of topic, just before we finish up today. You shall not give up to his master a slave who has escaped from his master to you. He shall dwell with you in your midst in the place that he shall choose within one of your towns, wherever it suits him. You shall not wrong him. Now, this is interesting because it has an American history tie-in. And because I'm going to run out of time, I'm not going to go there first. Remember that most of the slavery that happened amongst the Israelis was brought on by indebtedness. And for the Israeli people, it was a six-year maximum that you could be in debt like this. Because for Israeli people, the indebtedness ended when the sabbatical year began. This text may, in fact, be referencing slaves that have escaped to Israel from other places, because they are seeking refuge from their particular culture that was not being fair to them. And so there is a rescue effect that's being brought about here. So kind of chew on that, and the next time we get into the Word, we'll make some tie-ins to more modern applications of this.